Welcome to Stream of Unconsciousness, where I, a distracted dad on my commute home, regales you with all sorts of stories of randomness, which should be enough to keep you interested, but also boring enough to put you to sleep. Let's do it. All right, we've started the commute. We're on the freeway. So let's start getting you guys ready to go to sleep. I'm going to talk about being left-handed, which is a part of my life that is really large and looming over everything that is sort of part of me ever since I can really remember. When I was a young child, when I was in elementary school, I went to Catholic school from kindergarten all the way through fourth grade, and this was back, I don't know if they still have them, but in when I went to school, we had nuns as all of our teachers. Those were like the real nuns, like with the white habits and the long black flowing robes and names like Sister Mary Frances and all these other things like that. Fun side tangent, a number of years ago, my son, we were over at a hotel, staying the night in a hotel, my son, my wife, and myself. We turned on the television, and on the TV was The Flying Nun. Was this one of the actual terrestrial TV sets? We're in a hotel that was really proud of the fact that they had color TV and cable in every room. And my son, being a child of the 21st century, is used to things like YouTube and the internet and getting a lot of bite-sized entertainment that you can pause and rewind and skip. And so being in a room with this box that only had limited channels that you couldn't do any of those and see something interesting, wait, go back, watch it again, nope, that's not even an option. It is just what's on the TV is what's on the TV, and once it's done, it is gone to the world. So you'd better pay attention now. And if there's nothing interesting on, you just have to wait until something else revolves into view that is at least kind of interesting. Now, he was watching The Flying Nun, and he turned to my wife and myself, and he said, "Mom, Dad, what's a nun?" He was probably about 4 at this time, and my wife, being a wonderful 21st century parent, giving very open and politically correct description of when people believe in a god or a being or something greater than themselves, some of them will dedicate their lives to this in service to the god that they have chose, and they will. I said, "It's like a priest except a girl." And he said, "Oh, okay, cool." Watching TV about a nun. I was a child in schools, had nuns in my life all the way through for many, many years. And as a child, we had grades on handwriting. And in our handwriting grades, my grade was always a D. Now, I am don't have the best penmanship, I will be the first to admit. I often apologize to the people that I work with who have to sort of muddy through my horrible left-handed scrawl. But as a child, it was not great, but it was not terrible. It was mediocre plus. And I would think that mediocre plus would be at least a C. But my mother asked the nuns why they were constantly giving me D's in handwriting. And the reason was because I was using my left hand and I refused to try to use my right hand. And the left hand was not good. The right hand is what you're supposed to use because it's the right hand of God and it is the holy hand or something. And so that is why I was getting D's in handwriting. And thus began my impact of left-handedness, which continued through to the rest of my life and through today. I remember being in baseball. I was a gangly sort of child and continued to be a gangly sort of adult until I filled out. But as a gangly child in baseball, I could still just crack the ball really far away whenever I could make contact, except it was seemed unfair to the other children, because when I, as a left-hander, went up to bat, I would point the opposite direction, and so the balls that I would hit would fly in the different place in the outfield. And so if I, whenever I came up to bat, if I was batting left-handed, they would have to rotate the outfield to compensate for that. And so they didn't want to have to shift the outfield when I came up to bat, and then shift the outfield again when I was done and the next batter came up. And so I said, just to make it easier. And then the pitcher was used to throwing in a certain side of the plate and all this other such, that they thought it'd be easier for everybody if I just batted right-handed, which to me wasn't very fair, because as a left-handed person, batting the opposite direction meant that I didn't have as much power or precision. But well, that's how it was. Continued on through, well, I remember in elementary school taking notes. Part of every class was taking notes, and one of my teachers was grading me down on my notes because I was doing something weird. I was writing on the wrong side of the pages. So we had to turn in our notes after we were done with taking them, and so I would write on the back side of all the pages. And he called me in to ask why, because it was very weird to him to have to flip all my pages over, and why was I doing that? I said, well, it's because I'm left-handed, and if I'm writing in a spiral notebook, the spirals themselves rub against your hand as a left-handed person, and so it was uncomfortable. And so if I was to do that, I would have to push the margins way into the center of the page, and I wouldn't have a lot of room on the page to write, could, because my hand would get in the way and bump up against the spirals the entire time. It's like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And the same thing, if I'm in a three-ring binder, then I'd have those huge three rings to have to deal with. You could, of course, open the binder up, could take the rings out, but then I was the child that was causing the click, clack, click, clacking of my three rings, and being a distraction once again, pulling focus. And it was a lot easier when I got to use a computer or a typewriter for writing. That way, A, I didn't have to worry about my penmanship, and B, I didn't have to worry about weird margins or spacing or smearing ink. That was another thing that would happen as a left-handed person. You go and you write, and as you write, as a right-handed person, you write in a single line, and that ink continues in that line, and then by the time you get to the head of that line again, where you were, that ink has had the chance and opportunity to dry. And now you're a little bit lower, and you still can continue on and write a line, and it dries. And then you can continue in the next line. Whereas a left-handed person, as soon as you write, you are then in the next letter, pushing your finger further and further on that same row, and that line in the notebook. And so you are smearing that ink as you're going. Either that, or you have to do like the left-handed claw grip of your pencil, so that you tilt your entire hand, you pivot upwards, so that almost like the tips of your fingers are the only part of your whole hand that are actually making contact with the paper, and you rotate the whole thing around, so you hook your elbow up and your wrist continues in towards your body until the whole thing looks like you're trying to save your dinner from some person trying to steal your dinner rolls and Thanksgiving, as you hover around your work, or you're trying to hide and shield your notes from somebody who's trying to copy from you, when in reality you're just trying to write on a piece of paper without causing the ink to just pool all over your fingers and smear across the printed page. And when I got into typing, it was so much nicer. So much easier, none of that, except as a child too, I remember typing on a friend across the street. He had one of the only computers and one of the only printers at that time. And so we would go and use his computer to type up all of our reports and then print them all out. Or I think we had a computer and I could type it up, but I'd have to bring my floppy disk over to his house and it would then use that whirring sound and then load up and we'd have to print it out. But in those days, the printer were dot matrix printers where it made this horrible beep, beep, beeping and screeching noise, which I will not try to replicate here, because that would be the exact opposite of what we're trying to do to keep you guys ready for bed. But if you are a person of a certain age, the computer sounds that we had to deal with are A, nostalgic now that we're older, but B, we're shrill, piercing, terrible, and sort of anxiety-inducing if you were trying to hide the fact that you were either printing something or getting onto the internet from your parents. One of the so satisfying feelings, though, was at the end of your printing session, when you would take that dot matrix printer paper, you would tear it off at the bottom edge, and then you would fold and just delicately tear along the perforated edges down both sides of the printed page, and it would get beautiful crisp edges that you thought were crisp enough, but also still looked pretty cheap, because it's not like you had gone down to a print shop and printed it out on like real business paper. It still had that slight like bumpy perforated edges. So if you want to be a perfectionist, maybe you would try and do a little scissor work on the edges. But if you're left-handed, use right-handed scissors. Your left-handedness caused the scissors to open up at a gap where they connected, and so that wouldn't work to cut very well. I remember as a child, we would go to Pier 39 in San Francisco. Every year or so, we'd go on vacation or go and just to check it out, because we lived nearby enough. It was a nice daily trip out, and so we go to Pier 39, and at Pier 39, they had a left-handed shop. And in that left-handed shop, they sold things like left-handed scissors and a left-handed notebook, so I could go and I could do my notes on the quote-unquote correct side of the page and not have to worry about using the wrong side of the page or going into to the wrong margins. And then I could also tear it out of the spiral notebook and have a little perforation, but it would be on the correct side, and I could be like everybody else. Yay, normalcy. So we go through that as a child, and then in high school, we'd have the desks, and then you would sit at a desk, and they'd have right-handed desks and left-handed desks, which meant that the entrance into the desk and the way the desk was shaped would be either one side or the other side. And so it continued into college, and college was the absolute worst. Could deal with being a left-handed, not having a left-handed desk in high school, because the desks themselves were fairly sizable. In elementary school, it was fine because it was one large rectangle of desk. Then as you got older, the desks got more and more ergonomic, where they would have a little scalloped edge to them, up until when you got into college and you would be in a large lecture hall. The beautiful raked seating would go all the way up to the top rows. You'd look down on your professor on the small podium platform in the front. And more often than not, you would just sit in the chair, and so they'd want to have this big, open, nice seating. But if you had to take notes or, God forbid, take a Scantron test, you would have to pull up these little platforms. It'd be sort of like now they have them in the consoles in between seats in the airplanes, but in college you have in between each of the seats, to the right hand of the seat on the right hand side, you would reach behind you and you would pull up and then fold down in front of you a small half oval of desk. And so as a right-handed person, you would have that nice flat edge on the right-hand side, slight flat edge on the top, and it would continue through to make sure it doesn't bump into your stomach or jacket or whatever on the bottom. So you'd have a nice 90 degree edge of table to be able to write against. As a left-handed person, you would have that scalloped edge to try and balance your notebook or your whatever on, and you could never quite get it all the way over to the right. And so once again, you'd have to huddle against the right side of the desk. You'd have to sit there like a bear wrestling a salmon out of the stream. You would have to wrestle with your notes or wrestle with your Scantron to try and get enough room on the edge so that it doesn't flip over or fall off or anything. So continues into when you're 16, you're learning to drive, you have your first car. And your first car is, of course, a manual transmission or a stick shift, where you have the stick shift on the right-hand side. You have to manipulate that with your right hand and do that work with your right hand. A lot of detail work is done with the right hand or on the right-hand side, because that's what a majority of the world is used to using. Unless you're over in England, then you sit on the opposite side, which would be weird to me, because I'm used to typing and then using my right hand to use the mouse, except when I'm trying to do gaming, and as a gaming mouse, I flip it over to the left-hand side, or if it's on the right, and I just sort of have to cross my arms and use my right hand on the keys and my left hand on the mouse, which is pretty annoying. I've gotten used to driving stick shift using my right hand, but I tried to learn the piano, and in practicing the piano, the left-hand side of the keyboard, it goes from the lowest up to the right is the highest, and on the left-hand side of the keyboard are the low notes, which are the drone notes, the bass notes, the long, extended, big, chunky notes that you can hit. Now, on the right-hand side is normally where you have the high trilly notes, and you do a lot of the up and down flourishes along the keyboard with the right hand, and keep the left hand for these long, extended notes. And so it was difficult for me. I wanted to, like I did with a gaming mouse and the keyboard, cross my hands and sort of continue with my left hand up to do the, miming, the back and forth sort of like small, finite, precision detail keyboard stuff on the right, but it just isn't set up to be like that. I don't know of anyone, probably is, someone that's done a piano opposite, so that on the right is the low and the left would be the high, but that would be completely counterintuitive to everything else that you've been taught. Same thing happened when I was doing learning guitar. My teacher was right-handed, the guitar was right-handed, and so it would be easier for me if I just learned right-handed, and that way I could just mimic anything that I saw, anything else that was already there, all the key tabs, and all of that would be correct for me. Other people said, oh, you just flip it around the opposite way. But it's still hard. It's like it takes something in your brain to flip that whole thing around and look at it and just sort of mirror that in your head. Sort of like if you've got a teacher and you're not used to being someone who's a dance teacher, and so the dance teacher is looking and standing in front of you, facing you, then you're having to do opposite of what they're doing, and as they move, you move counter to that. It takes a little brain acrobatics to flip everything around. Once you get used to it, yes, you can do it, and then it seems weird not to do it. But the same sort of thing here, where you have to do a lot of that. So it's like a mental manipulation, if you will. But as an adult, I found that there are a lot of left-handed people who are in the sort of in creative roles, working over at Disney Interactive. We were in a creative meeting and noticed that people were flipping pens and messing around with pencils and doing a little stimming sort of things with their left hands, and took a pause and asked how many people around the table were left-handed. And it was the first time that I'd been in a room where a majority of people in the room were actually left-handed. And that was very interesting and weird to be part of the majority for once in that. So I didn't know or thinking a lot of hypotheses around if having to think of the world in a different way and manipulate the world in a different way throughout your life has caused these people to think more creatively and to think outside the box and see the world and view the world and manipulate the world in a different way because they're left-handed, or if we're just all slightly weirdos and so because of that we ended up getting into creative. So are we left-handed because we're creative, or are we creative because we're left-handed? And so that was a little fun nature and nurture back and forth between that. As an adult, my mother-in-law was trying to get me an interesting Christmas present, and so she bought me a calendar that was a left-handed calendar, and it had all sorts of interesting facts about left-handed people, a daily calendar, and every day it had a new fact. And so it was very interesting because the first fact was that Benjamin Franklin was left-handed. That was interesting. And almost the entire rest of the calendar was other not so great for left-handed people facts. Things like, in Italian, left-handed or left means sinistra, from the root sinister. Left-handed people were considered evil. Left-handed people were killed as witches and burned at the stake. Left-handed people are 17% more likely to die in an accident than right-handed people. Left-handed people will most likely have a lifespan that is X years less than right-handed folks. And on and on and on about these horrible facts about what either has happened to people who are left-handed, or what is the difficulties with being left-handed, or the terrible ways that the rest of the world views left-handed people. So it started as a fun, innocuous, almost gag gift, ended up just reinforcing a lot of the very negative stereotypes and things that were kind of weird about being a person who possibly as a child grasped the spoon or a block with the quote-unquote incorrect appendage early on, and then at that point doomed myself to a life of bad decisions when it comes to sports, and interesting people when it comes to careers. Office supplies used to be a really mystical big deal back in the day, for me at least. My dad was a plumber, and so I would go with him to, it must have been an Office Depot or something like that. I don't know what the version of it. It wasn't Staples, but it was like an office supply type Office Depot / Staples store. We'd have to go and get like the extra reams of paper and the pens and the pencils and all of these things. And I remember just being bored out of my gourd and trying to find something interesting to do, see, play with, and cajole him into purchasing for myself and my sisters whenever we were there. And there was literally nothing. It was just a bunch of weird post-it notes and other stuff that I had no care whatsoever. We would run over to the aisle that had food and see what there was, and they would have that very specific tin of cookies. And there was were the dry shortbread cookies that came in their own, like, little Pepperidge Farm sort of paper fold, like the little zigzaggy folded paper cups that they would get all nested into. And so they all tasted exactly the same. They all had different colors to them. Like, some had huge granules of sugar on top of them, and it was the only thing in this office supply store that had any sugar value whatsoever as a child. And so that is what my dad would purchase for us, or that's what he would have at his office when we came to visit him. And so that's what we would eat for snacks, were these little cookies. I remember my favorite were the ones that looked like little pretzels. They had a little pretzel, and instead of salt, they had the large crystallized sugar on the top of it. And like the rest of them, it tasted exactly the same as the weird scalloped wafer one next to it, or just the big chunky one next to it. That, and there was like having a, looked almost like a box of chocolates in this circular tin that a lot of people remember from also like their grandmother's house. Because when they were done with the cookies, now you had a big tin left over, and that would be for photographs or for buttons or notions or little sewing supplies or all sorts of little things like that. That would also be rather annoying as a child, where you would show up at your grandmother's house to be babysat, and she would have a, whatever reason, a large basket of uncracked nuts, and you weren't allowed to use the nutcracker because you were a kid and you would just make a mess. And so you wouldn't want to eat the nuts anyway because they were really old and dusty and rancid, and you're a child and you don't really like nuts anyway. But you would see the tin on the table next to it, and you would think, okay, well, might not be a lot, but score, she got some of them bomb shortbread cookies. And you would open it up, and if you were lucky, there'd be a couple small cookies left in there. If you weren't lucky, it would be grandpa's chewing tobacco or something like that. Or if you were okay lucky, it would be some interesting button thing or something that you could at least play around with while you were bored at grandma's. Office supplies were like, purchasing of them and having them and using them was always so mystifying as a kid. We would just, it became our art supplies. And so I remember wasting so much of my dad's paper just drawing and stuff like that at work. And then having the different kinds of pens. Do you remember as a child when you had the markers and the beginning of school every year, the smell of like that pencil case had a very distinct smell. Like, school in seasons was a bunch of different smells for me. Beginning of school year, the whole room smelled sort of like new erasers, because everybody would get their erasers, and that plasticky sort of eraser smell is a very specific smell. Both the pink ones that are like a rhombus sort of shape, like a parallelogram, sort of to high on one side and low on the other. That is a very specific smell. The smell of an eraser after it's been used, that sort of warm eraser smell. And then that very specific, like, Hello Kitty, Karopi, sort of, like, that eraser smell too is completely different. And that's what these little plastic cases would all smell like. Would smell like the super cutesy kawaii anime-esque character sort of smell of all those pencils and all the stuff inside it. That's the beginning of the school year to me. And then around Valentine's Day, there's a very specific smell of like the markers. And as a kid, markers get progressively less good smelling the older you get and the further through school you get. As a child, like in preschool, everything smelled like good Play-Doh, that sort of Play-Doh smell, and the smell of like white glue smell. And then kindergarten, first grade, you would have like the big sharp, not the Sharpies, but you'd have like the big markers, those big fat colored markers that would smell sometimes like different types of fruit. You'd have like the cherry smell, and just sit there as a little kid huffing all your different markers as you would go around. And then as you got older, you got the connections with the different erasers and the different sort of smelly pencils. Sometimes you would get scented erasers or scented pencils. And then as you got older into high school, it just became utilitarian number two pencils and ballpoint pens, which don't really have a smell, but you can mess with them and stick them on your tongue anyway, or stick them on your fingers. But then when you became an adult or in college, you would have like your graphing paper and pencils for that. And then you get into the age of Sharpies and whiteout that would just smell like gross. And it would have a very specific alcoholic sort of like chemical smell to them, which didn't smell like anything fun. It just smelled sort of like work. But then you would get used to that, and then that would also become a smell that as an adult now sort of smell markers. And it reminds me of doing like a report in California. We had to do a lot of, you at like fourth or fifth grade would have to do a report on California missions, and so you'd have to have a large piece of poster board. You'd have to write out your science fair project or your California mission project, and you would I invariably would have to have like two pieces of poster board, because I would mess up the first one and then have to flip it over on the backside and then have to go get most of the way through and then invariably mess up the second half of it. So like the night before, I would have to ask my mom to go over to the store and get me another one, and then we'd have to use that one, and I'd finally go and I'd write it in pencil and then have that eraser smell, and then I would go over it in pen, and then it would still be fresh and stinky when you brought it into class the next day, and everybody would have their posters, so the room start to smell like a bunch of like, it smells like waiting. It smells like people who were just didn't know that they were supposed to plan ahead. It smells like procrastination and a lot of regret at the end of the day. All these kids come in very last minute with their stinking posters. Some of them still have the ink on their hands for this, which was supposed to be a semester-long project, ended up being the night before. And that's how it always went. But as an adult, when I smell that smell, it brings up not those bad memories. I don't think about the terrible history reports that I had to do. I thought about all the fun times, about having to borrow encyclopedias from your friends. You're like, wait. I have the encyclopedia for A through K. Do you have M and N? Because I have to do mine on, my state is Minnesota, and I don't have the M encyclopedia. As a child, before the internet, you had to go to the library and check out books and make sure that you have those books with you to be able to write things down about your reports for your background information. You couldn't just Google something and get it from Wikipedia. You had to check out the books. Now, if you were like me and you procrastinated too long and you didn't get the books that you needed, you would hope that your parents had an encyclopedia which would have hopefully barely enough information for you to be able to obfuscate the truth about what you were supposed to do and sort of put in enough filler words and content to skate you by for the night. And then you would go through with your friends and see who had which encyclopedia, because your parents would buy them either from the stores would randomly sell encyclopedias, someone would come and sell them to you, or you would pick them up throughout the years, and invariably also the encyclopedias that you had access to were older than the globes that you had in your schools, so the information was very, very, very much out of date. But it didn't matter, because you were a kid and you tried to do whatever you could just to skate by. And today, kids can just go on the internet and see whatever they need to the day they need to do it, and then copy and paste that in with a simple right click, and it's so much easier. And A, I'm jealous, but B, at the same time, I also look back on those days, like the smelly, smelly Sharpies, longingly, because it was a simpler time, an easier time, a more boring adult time. We are halfway through my commute home, which means it's time for a new bit that I'm calling How Slow Do I Go? I'm gonna give you a little play-by-play as I continue my way, bobbing, weaving, ducking, and slowly stop and going as I progress through the beautiful Los Angeles commuter freeways. So I've picked up the pace a little bit tonight. I'm actually going a whopping 45 miles per hour this evening. That's a later night than normal. I'm coming back from an extended period out at the office and beyond. So it's an interesting sight for me tonight as I'm coming back from a trip on an airplane. And so I am coming back through a different way, which is interesting for me. I'm coming back from LAX, the Los Angeles International Airport. And as I continue on the 105 freeway going east, as I have the Pacific Ocean and the LAX airport at my back, I'm continuing on the 105, and I can see this long line of what looks to be almost like lamp posts or fireflies off in the distance, and they're actually about a half dozen planes that are queued up for their entry into Los Angeles, into the LAX airport. And it's interesting because they sit and twinkle in the nighttime sky, and they range all the way from the left of me. They get larger and then get smaller and progressively smaller in front, and then continue off to my right in almost as if you were looking into the nighttime sky and you saw what was the plane of the ecliptic, which is the line in the sky where all of the stars in the zodiac, as well as all of the planets in our solar system, are on this one sort of line in the sky. It would be as if you were to take a plate and all of the planets are on this same plate, and then you stick them to that plate with honey or molasses or glue or some kind of really sticky tape so that they don't fall off. Because next, what you're going to do is you take that plate, you lift it, you look at it on the edge, and you tilt it at like a 33 degree angle towards you, and you look edge on to the plate and hold it in front of you, nice and akimbo, nice and on the edge, so that you can see the different dots of the different planets or the different stars. And you look at that, and so you look at that with the background backdrop of the rest of the nighttime sky, and that makes that plane. And so if you were to shrink yourself down to little pea-sized and stand right in the middle of that plate and look around you, it would look like there were a ring of these different dots around you. And as the plate continued to spin, or as you spun, which is what happens, we being the Earth, spins around on our axis, looking at different parts of the sky throughout the night. The stars, well, much as we can see, don't move amongst the background. We are the ones that are looking around and pivoting and looking at different parts of the sky throughout the night. And then also, as we then continue around our journey around the sun, 364 and change, 65 and change days of the year, you're looking and pointing at different parts of the sky throughout the year as well. And so everything seems to change from your perspective. And the same thing here as I continue on my trip now, dipping down to a whopping 12 miles per hour on the 105 freeway. These planes continue to queue up, now more to my left than to my right, but they do twinkle because of the nighttime turbulence. It's the reason why stars twinkle. It's because you're looking through the air, and the air is moving as you're looking through it. It would be almost as if you were to take a picture and put a picture at the bottom of a swimming pool, and you can see the detail in that picture. It's a picture of someone's face. You can see their smiling face, see the color of their eyes, their eyebrows. One is arched quizzically, not so much in a The Rock Dwayne Johnson sort of fashion, but just inquisitive, as in, why did you take a picture of me and stick it at the far end of the pool? Is this a laminated picture? Because otherwise, you're going to get little picture bits all in your filter, and that's not going to do anyone any good. And so you're looking at this picture at the bottom of this pool, and then all of a sudden, you swirl the pool up, and then sure enough, the picture, which is nicely stuck to the bottom of the pool, so don't worry, it's not going anywhere. That picture, then, you can't see it as well because that water is swirling around on top of it and messing up the angles and everything, so you can't see your picture as well. The same thing happens when you're looking up into the nighttime sky. When you're looking at the stars twinkle more on the horizon, because if you're looking up, you're looking straight up through less air. You're looking down towards the horizon. There's a longer angle of air for you to look at. And so everything tends to bounce around and shimmer and shake the further down towards the horizon you get. And so you get those nice dancing stars. And the difference between stars and planets, you know, stars twinkle, planets don't. I think that's how it goes. I don't know. We'll figure that out another time. And the same thing here, looking at these different planes, the same thing happens. The closer planes to me have less twinkle than the ones that are further away, which seem to pop in and out through the beautiful late night or early evening sky in the kind of dusty and funky Los Angeles smoggy air. And that's what I'm looking at now. I'm looking at the backs of cars, numerous cars, two lanes to my left, and the subway or the metro system on my left. The metro in Los Angeles being mediocre plus-ish. I had the privilege to live in France for a number of years and made use of the French metro system when I was on my commute to work and back a number of times. And it's very fast, it's very clean, there are stops everywhere. Traveling around the world, it's almost depressing to see how much better a majority of at least the major cities around the world are with their metro systems than we are here in America, at least in Los Angeles. New York has an amazing metro system, but the difference between a metro and a subway in Northern California around by San Francisco and Oakland. They have the BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, and that is pretty good, especially when you want to go to a concert or want to go to a sports ball game at what used to be the Candlestick Park, but has now changed names so many times. Petco Park and whatever.com has paid the most to be able to rename it most recently Park, so that you don't have to drive in and have to deal with all of that crazy traffic. You can take the rapid transit system instead. Looking off to my left, I can see the fenced off section of the subway / metro here for Los Angeles. The metro being okay when it works and absolutely horrendous when it doesn't. Now, the problem too with the metro in Los Angeles is that the metro doesn't go everywhere you want it to. The metro here has a short line that goes to the actual airport, but that line doesn't actually connect up with any of the other metro lines that you want to. They're continuing to. It someday, hopefully soon, will connect all the way through so that you could go to downtown Los Angeles, or you could come into Los Angeles, fly into our international airport, and then possibly take a metro from the airport to your destination, wherever you're going in the greater Los Angeles area, be that downtown Los Angeles, Santa Monica, or out towards Pasadena, or possibly out towards friends that are over in the opposite valley on the other side. As it is now, that is not a possibility. If I wanted to take an airplane, I'm having to do what I'm doing now, which is drive my own car out to the airport, park at the airport, or you can take an airporter, which is a bus that goes from the Union Station over in downtown Los Angeles, a beautiful old Art Deco station that is gorgeous. And right next to a number of shops, there's the two of the oldest, what they claim to be, both of them claim to be the originator of the French dip sandwich in Los Angeles. And so they're there. You can also take the metro a stop or two to Little Tokyo, or another stop the opposite direction to Chinatown. A lot to do right there, and ample parking. It would be great to be able to take that directly to the airport, but no, you have to get into a bus, and that bus will then drive you the rest of the way to the airport. So I would then have to go from my house, take a Lyft and Uber, or walk a number of miles down to the local metro station there, take that metro down to Union Station, and then take a bus from Union Station here to LAX to go to the airport, which is ridiculous, especially in the 21st century, where I expect to have a jetpack or rocket cars or jet boots or a transporter or something like that to get me from point A to point B. But that's not what we have. We can order a random thing like a rubber chicken from Amazon and have that delivered same day with Prime, but I cannot have less than two stops or changeovers to get from my house to my local airport. Now, when I go to the airport, I have an option to choose my own flights. And so this last time, I took the opportunity to look at all flights, not just flying from LAX, but flying from Burbank, or they're the tiny little they're the tiny little airports in Van Nuys or Santa Monica or Oxnard. And so I looked at the prices for those and found what would be a great flight in and out of Van Nuys Airport and would be about the right times that I wanted to go. And if I wanted to fly Southwest out of LAX, it would cost around $200-something. Now this flight in and out of Van Nuys would only cost $4,850. So what a deal. Now, needless to say, I was unable to get the approval to fly in and out of Van Nuys, and so I am driving now on the 105 freeway with loud cars, louder motorcycles, and passing all of these ladybug-like plane of ecliptic planes up in the sky. Now, if you look at all of the plane of the ecliptic in the nighttime sky, you can see all of the signs of the zodiac are also on that ring in the sky. And so if you want to know what sign you are, it's not the zodiac sign that is seeable in the sky when it's your birthday. It is all of the planets in the solar system and the sun are all in those different places in the sky. And so when you're born, it is where the sun is on that plane of ecliptic. When you were born is what your sign is. And so when people come up, I used to work in college at the Griffith Observatory, and people would come up on their birthdays and say, "Hey, I'm a Cancer." And then their significant other would say, "Boy, don't I know it." And then there'd be that funny ha-ha banter back and forth for a little bit. But then they would say, "No, it is now the end of June. That is my sign is Cancer. And so I want to see where Cancer the crab is, where that constellation is in the sky in honor of my birthday." And we would say, "Terrific. It is where the sun is in the morning. So where it is now is exactly opposite where you are on the earth at this moment." And we would have to describe that to people. And so you could see where the different planets are. And so because all of these different planets have very known orbits around the sun, we know how long it takes for each of the planets to move around the sun, we know where their position is right now, and because of that, we can then go forwards or backwards in time and tell, because of math, where these different planets would be. And that's how you slash astrologers know what your sign is. And so we can say, okay, at this date, at this time, in this location, what was the sky like? Because the sky changes where you are based how high or low you are on the earth, because you see different parts of the sky looking at that map, looking from the different slice of the plate wherever you were. You see different parts of the background of stars throughout your location, depending on where you are. And so we can know, reversing back through time, what planets would be in which of those different constellations at the moment of your birth. And so that's why they can say, okay, this planet was either going up in its orbit or coming back in its orbit. And so that's where you have the ascending or descending. And that's why when everybody says Mercury is in retrograde, and Mercury being in retrograde happens all of the time, because every 88 days, or so, Mercury makes one orbit around. And so you have a 50-50 chance every 44 days of Mercury either going up in its orbit into view or then coming back out of it on the other side. So And that's why you have your sign that you have, and that's why you also have the inability to look at where your sign is when it is your birthday. There are special ways to drive on freeways that locals know, that people who aren't from the area don't know about. But some people take full advantage of them and others just don't understand. And this is unfortunate because this is the way that people drive in Los Angeles. If you were from another country or another place of the country where people drive the way they should, fast people on the left, slow people on the right, then this seems completely backwards, because many of the roads here, if I continue through downtown Los Angeles, whenever a major freeway bisects another freeway, invariably the two right-hand lanes will become a snarled, twisted group of very slow traffic. And that means that when you know that's coming up, it's your duty to move over to the left. And there are a lot of people that go through zigging, zagging through the traffic like that. And that's just being a jerk. I don't do that. I know that, okay, this is going to slow down over here, so I should go into this lane at this point. And then around this corner here, it's going to slow down because there's going to be a merging that's going to happen on the left-hand side. So that means that for this point, I should continue on the rightmost lanes as I continue through the rest of here. And then now it opens up again and everyone can continue driving however they see fit. There is no best lane. There was a comic a number of years ago where there's one guy that was driving and someone that was in the passenger seat, and the passenger turns to the driver and says, "Hey, what's all of this machinery doing in the back of your car?" In the panel there are these large, looked almost like a radio with all sorts of antennas and different things on it, and the driver said, "Oh, well, they're doing, it's a special piece of tracking machinery, because it seems that wherever I go, that's always the slowest lane." Womp womp. And it seems like that for me and for all of us sometimes. You see the lane in the middle start going faster and you move to that lane, and that of course means that that lane then becomes the slow lane, and you see the lanes on the left and the right of you whipping past, and so you find an opening, you move to the right, and then that lane stops, and then the middle lane becomes the fast lane. And we would play this game, I don't know if other people do it, this is what I do, where I sort of find one token vehicle for each lane, and so long as I am faster or further ahead than that vehicle, then I think like I'm okay. There's this red Jeep on my left now. There's a large red tractor trailer in front of me, and then a small white Honda on my right. Now, I just want to judge how well I'm doing based on where my position is in the lanes compared to those other vehicles. So, and then hopefully you get far enough ahead that you can then reassess and leapfrog that way. But sometimes you think you're doing really well, you continue on, you've bounced back and forth a little bit, you've made some great choices, you've picked your lanes correctly, you've moved forward between them strategically, and then you look to your left, and then that red Jeep that you would have sworn you'd passed by a long time ago then continues past your view. And you know, at that point, defeated that more or less whatever lane you choose, unless there's a catastrophic accident, will be more or less the same. But I just passed that red Jeep, and I don't know why, but it feels really good and vindicating to me. I was going to be this nice Zen thing because I saw him move past me and I was going to let it go. But now, I'm sorry, red Jeep. Now you are the enemy and you must be destroyed. I have to leave you in my wake. Oh, but you're one, you're like me. You're zigging and zagging a little bit through, knowing where the ebbs and flows, where the different tides and currents and eddies are in the natural flora and fauna of the freeway system of Los Angeles, and you're making your way back to me as well. I wonder, am I his mark as well? Is he using me to judge his progress, just as I'm using him to judge mine? Is that going to mean that there's going to be like a battle of the placement going to happen sometime soon? So that's where I will end today's sleepy time. Was no matter what happens, no matter who you are or what you do, invariably you will end up as someone else's mark on the Los Angeles freeway system.